Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us on Lit Radio Podcast. I'm Teja, and today I'm joined by Neil Francis. We'll talk about his latest title, The Leadership Book, Achieving the Empathetic Edge. Neil is a leadership advisor who works with leaders and organizations to build empathetic, resilient, and high-performing cultures. He supports senior leaders and teams to navigate change, make difficult decisions with clarity, unlock potential, and lead with confidence under pressure. The Leadership Book shows how empathetic leadership strengthens trust, improves well-being, enhances creativity, and drives sustainable performance. It challenges the myth that empathy is a soft skill, revealing instead how it supports clear judgment, accountability, and effective decision-making under pressure. Hi, Neil. It's a great pleasure to have you with us again on Lit Radio Podcast. How are you today?
I'm fine, Tia, and it's really nice to see you again.
Yeah.
This is probably, is this the third book we've worked together on?
I think so, yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, but so, yeah, it's great to have you back.
Great, thank you.
And so let me start with my first question, which is why you decided to write the new title, The Leadership Book.
Yeah, well, I wrote the book because I believe leadership is probably fundamentally understood at the moment. We've spent decades focusing on strategy targets, which are really important, so I'm not saying they're not, but there are other things that are as important or not more, and also authority. People have been managed in the past and not led in some organizations. But the real difference between average organizations and exceptional ones is how people feel when they come to work. Empathy has often been dismissed as a soft skill, you're soft if you do that as a leader. But the evidence, all the evidence and my own experience shows the opposite. It's a performance skill, and it's the strongest skill a leader can have. And I wanted to create something practical and accessible that helps leaders understand that empathy isn't just about nice. It's about making better decisions, building stronger teams, and creating organizations that improve and endure. But I think it's also to say that it doesn't mean empathy doesn't mean lowering expectations. There will be moments that call for clarity, boundaries, and different decisions. But leading with empathy means handling these moments calmly, fairly, and crucially with respect.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to talk a little bit more about empathy and why you think it's such an essential skill. But before we do that, could you tell me and our listeners, what was it like to write this book? Obviously, you've already written quite a few books. So what's your writing process now?
Yeah, this is my sixth book. Five I've already done with you, and it's been a great journey and relationship with you over the years. So I knew by this point of the leadership book that the process is never just about sitting down and writing. It's about observing, reflecting, and connecting ideas over time. So every chapter in all my books start with a story. Sometimes it's someone I've worked with, someone I've met, and sometimes it's a story I've come across in a book, a TED talk, or an article. These stories bring the leadership ideas to life. I think you need to connect it to real people and real events and real things. And for me, leadership is better understood through real human experience, not abstract theory. Stories show what leadership actually looks like under pressure, in uncertainty, and in moments that really matter. The writing itself was very reflective. It makes me thought about my old journey, what I've learned, what some big mistakes I've made in the past, and what generally makes a difference. So in many ways, the book is a collection of those stories and lessons brought together to help leaders see empathy not as a soft idea but as a practical leadership advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's expand on that a little bit. As you've already said a couple of times, empathy, it's not a soft skill. It is actually what drives performance, judgment, and results. And also during your first response, you said something very interesting that in a lot of companies, people are being managed and not led. So what's the difference between the two? And obviously, why do you believe that empathy is so important in all of that?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting that I think the opening story, actually in the introduction, tells my first experience of having a proper job. I was selling life insurance for an insurance company, which I won't mention. And for the first 6 months when I joined, I was a top salesperson. And the kind of the way that they would teach you how to sell was that every Thursday evening in Edinburgh, in the office in Edinburgh, you would have to get on the phone and make 20 appointments for the next couple of weeks. And all the stats showed that if you to do that, you would probably sell 4 to 5 policies out of those 20, and you would you'd hit your target. And I did that. And then after 6 months, I don't know why, I just started to maybe not as motivated and all that. And then my Scottish manager's real management style came into play. And every Thursday, he would call all the salespeople across Scotland. And he had a mobile phone in his car. So this is 1988, so it's a long way back. And he'd call up, he'd say, "Hi, Neil, how you doing? Blah, blah, blah. How many appointments have you got?" And if he hadn't got to 20 or you're quite close, he'd go completely silent with you. Utterly silent. And then you start to panic and say things. And then he would absolutely go bonkers and yell at you and say, "You can't go home until you do this, you know, and if you don't do that, you know, I'm going to have to get really strong with you," and so forth. And there was lots of swearing and so forth. And he'd slam the phone down and you wouldn't leave until you got these 20 appointments. Now, that is management. I would say it's bullying, to be honest, but it's management. You know, they don't trust us to do. Saying that, it taught me a fantastic skill of resilience, and it taught me just about sales, which is a fundamental basement of everything they do. So that's what I think. And okay, so let's continue to talk a bit about management styles for a second. My experience wasn't unique back then, and sadly, it's still not common today. Many managers, I would say, operate for fear and intimidation rather than trust and respect. Case in point, Jacob Rees-Mogg. Remember when the COVID restrictions eased and civil servants were encouraged to return to their office? Rees-Mogg took it upon himself to patrol Whitehall like some story, like some sort of attendance officer. If he found an empty desk, he would leave this charming note saying, "Sorry you were out when I visited. I'm just looking forward to see you in the office very soon." This is old school, which screams distrust. If you're not physically at your desk, you must not be pulling your weight. It's management by suspicion. And for me, it just doesn't belong in the leadership in today's world. That's why I wanted to really talk about leadership styles where empathetic edge is at the absolute core of it all, and kind of park all these old management styles and focus on the new ones going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, talking about your first manager and that second example you gave, obviously a lot of people are still being managed by their managers. So let's see what an empathetic leader look like in comparison. What kind of skills does an empathetic leader possess?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think an empathetic leader is calm, self-aware, and deeply attentive to others. They listen more than they speak. They don't rush to judgments. They create an atmosphere where people feel safe to contribute and take risks. Yeah. Important. Empathy doesn't mean lowering standards. As I said earlier, empathetic leaders still have to make tough decisions, but they're doing it with clarity, fairness, and humility. People follow him, not because they have to, but they want to do. And that is a key thing, you know. And
I just think it's such a fundamental principle of valuing people who you work with. And if you do that, all the evidence shows that you will be successful as an organization, because empathy improves the quality of decisions. And when leaders understand people, their motivations, pressures, and concerns, they make better judgments. They anticipate problems earlier. They build trust faster. And as you'll see in the book, research across 42 global studies shows empathy strengthens trust, creativity, well-being, and performance. And beyond research, it's absolute common sense. People give their best effort when they feel seen, valued, and trusted. Empathy unlocks commitment, and commitment drives performance.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, because if you feel safe in your workplace, then you're performing better. But before we talk more about that, at the start of the book, you discuss the leader's personal journey. So that's self-acceptance, self-belief, and self-awareness. So why is that so important when it comes to being an empathetic leader?
Yeah, because leadership is a inside out process. So if you lack self-awareness, your fears, insecurities, and your blind spots, and I do talk a lot about that in one chapter about blind spots, that will shape your decisions, often unconsciously. And self-acceptance and self-belief create stability. They allow leaders to remain calm under pressure and make clearer decisions. Before you can understand others, you have to understand yourself. Self-mastery creates leadership credibility.
Right. And then you talk about how to lead through strengths and failures. So obviously we've all heard that we should be learning from our mistakes and obviously make sure that we focus on what we are best at. But how do we do all of that with empathy?
Yeah, it's really interesting this. I mean, so one of the chapters is about strengths and why it's very important to lead with people's strengths. And I talk about two kind of tools you can do that. And one is called Strength Finder, which is a Gallup tool. And it is, Clifton Gallup Strength Finder tool. And what that basically does, it identifies your top five strengths. Gallup interviewed about 20 million people about 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and they identified what are the top 34 strengths or talents that people have. And for me, a couple of them is I have what's called empathy is one of my top ones. So I can walk into a room and I can pick the atmosphere straight away. I've got another strength, which is to do with adaptability. So I can cope with many things being thrown at me as a leader. Yeah, I've got maximizer, which means we're going to do it 100%. I've got a terrible one, which is called activator, which means just do it. So I'm a nightmare to work with if you haven't done something. And I've got what's called intellection. That's not something I'm clever, but if I was to bump into you in the airport, and you said, "Oh, why don't we go on the flight together to London?" I would not like that because that's the time I get my space and I think I need to process all my thinking. Now, at the bottom of some of my strengths are discipline. I'm actually useless at that sort of thing, and focus. And so what you're trying to do with is get the strengths, identify what there is for your team, and then use those to drive your company. And what's really, really interesting is, as you know, I had a stroke about 20 years ago and I had lots of cognitive issues from it. Prior to the stroke, those five strengths were that after the stroke, the sixth one came to fifth and fifth went to sixth. So nothing changed, even when I had a massive stroke. So that's just how powerful the Strength Finder is. And from that, basing that around empathy allows leaders to see strengths and failures as opportunities for growth, not judgment. Empathetic leaders recognize individual strengths, as we're saying, and crucially create environments where those strengths can flourish. And when failure happens, which will absolutely go on, and I talk about that in the book as well, they respond with curiosity, not blame, and they learn so much from it. Failure as a leader will give you far, far, far more lessons than success ever will. And all of this builds learning, confidence, and resilience. People don't grow in an environment of fears, they grow in environments of trust.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like what you're saying that you learn a lot from failure. But also, on the other hand, when someone fails at something, they might then feel really self-conscious and worried about the whole situation. So, what's your advice in when that happens, when something goes really badly, but you still have to learn from the experience and not shut down?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had some very serious business failures, you know. I've exited from a company twice, and literally we had to put a company which I worked with my son, a digital health company, into liquidation last year after 10 years. So I've seen the strengths, I've seen the successes and all that when you sell a business and all that, and also the failures. And it's a very painful thing, especially when you've been working with your son for 10 years in the business. So I think the biggest thing I've learned is don't you will do it, but really try and limit how much you regret going back. Because, you know, I have this philosophy: as long when you make a decision, you're firstly listening to people, you maybe get some advice, and then you make the decision. At that time, it was the right decision. Now, moving on, you know, we were certain we were going to get investment into our business. And we did all the right things, but subsequently it just didn't happen. And after many opportunities of pitching, we just had to call the day. But on that journey, I can look back and say, yes, it's really painful. And yes, we lost money and various other things. But at the time, they were the right decisions. And that's what I'd say to anybody who has. And you will learn so much from failure. I keep going on about that. I mean, the great example of this is America. So if you go to America, they see failure as a success. Actually, they like it when a startup comes in and they've had a failure before. Yeah. Whereas Britain, it's changing. But if you fail, people kind of think, oh, well, it can't be that person can't really manage very well and so forth. But a lot of businesses started in another version or tried something else. They failed, they dust themselves down, and then they start again and they take that experience into their new business. And there's loads of evidence that, especially in America, those businesses that tried again become far more successful. For those that failed first. And it's the same in Britain. But the fact that I think it's something like a person, a company that fails, the leadership team or the directors, probably 70% won't try again. But 30% that do become far more successful. And that's the key thing about failure. So failure is a good thing, it really is. In leadership, and especially around empathetic leadership.
Yeah, you do learn a lot from failure. And earlier you said that when it comes to failure, a leader should be responding with curiosity and not blame. And actually, you have a whole chapter in the book about the power of curiosity. So could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So, I actually. My last book I wrote with you was a creative thinking book, and that kind of curiosity is one of the key things in that. But basically, curiosity is the engine of empathy. You cannot understand someone unless you're genuinely curious about their perspective. You know, curious leaders ask questions. They listen. They remain open. And curiosity, I can't pronounce that, prevents. Leaders from becoming rigid, defensive, and overly certain. It keeps them learning, and it keeps the organization adapting.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and then let's move on to another part of the book where you argue that the strongest organizations are built to collective, we-focused leadership. So why do you think that's?
Well, there's a that comes from the last chap is the last chapter? Yeah, sorry, yeah, it's the second last chapter before I wrap everything up, and it's called We, and it tells the story of the Ryder Cup last year in America, where the captain of Europe, Luke Donald, he had a very much inclusive way of leading. Everything was we. It was never I. It was never I am the great leader here. Yeah, you're going to follow me because I've been very successful in the past. He used this huge philosophy of we. We're in it together. We're going to win together. We're going to win. We're going to lose together. And that just translated into that team. So you could just see they are a team, not team, not individuals. Whereas the Americans, who fantastic, brilliant golfers, on paper, the 12 that they had against our 12, probably better, but their leader kind of led more with I, I this, I that. And some of their players, it's I. Now, that can work in some ways, but in the medium to long term, it's just not going to work at all. And you could do that with any of your managers or leaders that you currently work with, or anybody's listening here, you know that those leaders say, "We won together. We got that business together," as opposed to, "I led the pitch. I won it." Yeah, it's at the start, it's great because a bit of a buzz, but your team will know that those who say, I just don't really care for them and they have no value. And therefore, yeah, because no organization's success succeeds through individual brilliance alone. They'll have superstars now and again and so forth, but overall, you've got to have this we. And so sustainable success is a collective. And when leaders shift from I to we, something really powerful happens. People feel ownership, they feel responsibility, they feel invested. That creates resilience, alignment, and performance. Empathy creates unity, and unity creates strength.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say as well, Neil. Once we start hearing that, we are doing things, obviously people feel more appreciated because their efforts are appreciated. So yeah, I really like that part in the book. How can leaders do that in practice? How can they build that collective leadership style? What kind of changes they should implement in the way they lead and communicate so they can actually build that collective feeling?
Well, you're not, it depends what sort of leader you are, but if you are a very much a we one or an I one, whatever it is, it starts with small behavioral shifts because, we've all been in rooms where leaders have made this massive change. We're going to do X, Y, Z, and we're going to change the world. Whatever. Nothing happens. Nothing happens. They all get motivated. We all get motivated. Oh, wow, yeah, we're going to hit these targets and whatever, open this new office. But normally, it goes back to normal business. So it starts with small behavioral shifts. Sharing credit is crucial. As I just said, that's the wee thing. And listening deeply, asking for input, admitting mistakes. Now, it doesn't mean that at the end of the day, as the leader, you will make the final decision if it's required. Okay, so you're not saying, oh, this is all going to be lovely. It's kind of we're all together, we're going to make decisions together. The leader leads, but there's ways to do it. And by doing all this, these behavior brings psychological safety, and psychological safety brings trust. And over time, that trust becomes culture, and culture ultimately determines performance. One thing I'd just like to say that I've written this book, and a lot of it is written from the bad mistakes I've made. Okay, so when you do these talks or these podcasts. This is I'm not basing all of this on the perfect leadership style I've had. Just talk to my son. Well, I worked with him for 10 years. I said, well, lots of, so I do, I made loads of mistakes. And, I'm embarrassed some of the ways I act and treated with people. But over time, you start to realize that with experience, it just caring and valuing people will give you so much better performance within your company or organization or charity or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, that goes back to the question about strengths and failures. So
It
yeah,
is, it is, it is. Yeah. I mean, I could write another book about the mistakes I've made, how I acted in certain things, and you can look back and think, I should have handled that really bad. I lost the plot. I might have yelled at people. So I've had all those. So I got lots. I've got all the war stories about some of the things I'm embarrassed about how I led. But over time, I'm just trying to get the word out. That just does not work. It just doesn't. It works in the short term, no doubt. But if you want the people that will work over the weekend, that if the business is really struggling, you're going to say, listen, I've not been able to make give you a pay raise this year, or you've got to get this out tonight. And those people will, if they felt they've been valued and trusted, they will do that. They'll absolutely do that for you. And that's what you do, because when they've got problems at work, sorry, at home, and they maybe need to go home early, or there's something with the children, or there's something with the family, and you say, you just go home now, well, it's fine. They will remember that. And it's the best investment you will do on valuing people in that situation.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and when it comes to the mistakes and failures, yeah, it's really important to come out of that not angry, but to learn something and yeah, become more empathetic as a result. Great.
Great.
And finally, Neil, I've got one last question. So to conclude this very interesting conversation, can you share with us what happens in excuse me. So, can you share with us what happens in organizations when leaders lead with empathy and build that collective collaboration? Is that the empathetic edge that you talk about in the book?
Yes, absolutely. Because everything changes if you do that, and decision making improves, trust challenges, sorry, trust strengthens, engagement increase, and innovation grows. And that is absolutely key. Those four things: people feel safe to contributing their best thinking, and organizations become more resilient, more adaptable, and more human. That's what I call the empathetic edge, and it's not soft. Trust me, it's the strongest skill a leader can have and provides the leadership advantage.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. But thank you very much, Neil, for your time today. It was very interesting, as always, to chat with you about your book. And of course, I encourage our listeners to grab a copy of the leadership book. But thank you very much for your time.
It's great talking with you again, and have a good rest of the day.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.